Elliot, how was All-Star Weekend? Welcome back.
It was good. We, you know, the people of St. Louis, man, they love their hockey. They were right into it.
We were talking about it. We can continually go to the debate of what does the All-Star game have to give us. But if you just look at that market and all the St. Louis tie-ins, the alumni that got involved, the Tkachuk family, amongst numerous other, I guess, on the heels of a Stanley Cup championship, things around the team, that would have been seen as what, a slam dunk hit in the local market there?
Oh, no question about it. Like, they love their alumni there. And the fact that they won the cup last year and all those alumni were there, it's enormous. Like, they love the Tkachuks. They love their guys who retired there. They love the, you know, there was that one draft where the, what, six St. Louis kids were drafted, you know, from, you know, including Trent Frederick and Joseph Woll a bit later on. You know, they love, they're hardcore about their hockey. And on Friday night, the ovations were pretty loud when those alumni showed up. We were worried Brett Hull was going to fall off the platform, but we're pretty happy that he didn't.
He didn't sing either, I'm told. So, hey,
that's also another good news.
Yeah. What did you like about some of the newer parts of the format this year? The women's 3-on-3 I thought was great. Love your thoughts on that. And then also the new skills event. What did you think?
Well, I thought the women's 3-on-3 was excellent. It was the most competitive. It was probably the most competitive event of the weekend. They had a lot on the line. They knew that was an important showcase for them, and they delivered. I don't know how anybody could have a problem with that. I liked the shooting star. I liked everybody else. I got confused about what counted when you hit the net and what didn't. I think obviously they're going to have to fix that if they do that again. I just think the whole night has to be a little bit shorter. I thought the save streak went too long. I love the fastest skater. I love the hardest shot. Maybe the target shooting, they have to go back with the styrofoam. But the shot from the crowd, good idea. Maybe we have to fix the netting so the scoring is more easily explainable, and maybe a couple less people doing it. But I don't think you can ever fault them for trying something new. So I look at it as good idea, needs some tweaks. And I just think the whole night needs to be a little bit shorter. Like, if it was half hour shorter, maybe, I thought it would be perfect.
Elliot Friedman's with us as he joins us every Monday on Pinder and Steinberg. Are you still offended, or were you at any point offended by Green Day?
No. Like that, that doesn't bother me at all. Now, I wonder if it bothers the league. It's something that's going to be, we're going to have to follow up on. I think they've got one more year on their contract with the league. Like, the thing that made me laugh is that Billy Joel, the Holiday, the front man, he just doubled down. Like, he was like, he heard, I think he must have heard the reaction the first time. Like, there was this sort of like that came out of the crowd, and he's like, I'm just going to do it some more. Like, I'm a bit of the, like, I'd rather beg for forgiveness than ask for permission kind of guy. So when people do stuff like that, I generally kind of laugh at it. But I understand that this is supposed to be a kid-friendly event and somebody's going to have a problem with it. It's not going to be me, but it's something we're going to have to follow up over the next couple of weeks.
For sure.
NBC had a sponsor, and not a sponsor, but NBC had somebody manning had a sensor, and we didn't.
Well, I was in Las Vegas watching, and yeah, it got bleeped out on NBC. I didn't know it didn't get bleeped out on Sportsnet until afterwards. So, it was definitely delayed on NBC. On a more serious note, still involving the All-Star game, what did you make of the new player tracking? And I'm curious as to your observations as to how it translates and changes our watching experience of hockey, specifically in a few months come the postseason when it's expected to be in all 16 playoff rings.
You know, I didn't watch a lot of the tracking yesterday. I didn't have an alternate feed in front of me. So I don't really have a great answer for you there, Pat. But one thing that, you know, is a bit relevant to all this is we released a 31 Thoughts podcast interview today with Brad Tree Living. And in it, we talked at length about the database that has been created for the Flames under Chris Snow. And, you know, he wouldn't go into it too much, but he talked a lot about kind of what goes into it. And I think there's a lot of people who do interesting stuff out there in the public realm. And I don't want any of them to be upset at what I'm about to say, because I think they do good work. But what they tell, but what people around the league tell me is it's barely scratching the surface of what the teams look at. Like right now, one of the things that people are really doing a lot of work on is expected goals. And I started to look into expected goals, and I asked some teams that I think are pretty smart analytics teams, like, what do they think about some of the public expected goals models? And their answer is, you know, some of those people work very hard and are very creative, but it's not really anything close to what we have available to us. And I said, well, what's the difference? And they said, we have a lot more stuff that isn't publicly available. And they just feel that there's a lot more that they do in terms of the good teams, in terms of how they scrape the data, how they put it together, you know, the amount of people they have working for them, that they think there's so much more out there. And I think the player tracking is going to give us a better idea of what potentially is out there. And that's what I'm looking forward to. I want to see how it changes our eyes and gives us a better chance of the value. Like, for example, you know, one of the best young players in the league right now is Quinn Hughes. He's a great passer. We can't really measure what kind of a passer he is. I've been told this data is going to give us ideas to quantify what a great passer he is. Like, that's the stuff I want to see. So I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, what it means. I'm curious to see how it measures how tired players get. Like, in Toronto right now, Keith, he's not a four-line guy. He rides his horses. And I asked him once, I said, you know, like, you know, how do you know when you can play? Like, I think Tavares had like a 26-minute game, or Matthews had a 27-minute game. I said, how do you know if you can do that? And he says, a lot of the time it's by eye test. How are they when they're coming to the bench? Now, the Maple Leafs do a lot of sports science stuff, but you can't do that during the games, really. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about what these guys can do, and I'm really excited to see it.
Do you feel like at this point, none of this data or very little of this data is publicly available? As the NHL starts to do it officially and incorporate it on its broadcast and very likely bring it into what we can access on NHL.com, do you expect pushback from teams, knowing that right now this is what they believe proprietary? They're very closely guarded when it comes to talking about this. How much pushback do you expect there to be if and when the NHL rolls this out?
Well, I think that's going to be that's a great question. I think we're still trying to determine, will this be public information?
Mm-hmm.
Like, will the data itself be public? And you know what? It's something that I will look back into again, because it's a question I've asked before and I haven't gotten a straight answer. You've given me something to do, Pat.
Oh, well, I've
thanks,
feel like
thanks
I've
for making my day busier, Pat. You're a real pain in the butt. You know that?
I was aware of that, to be perfectly honest. So I'm glad that I've lived up to my reputation.
I gotta look back into it. Like, I asked it once if it would be publicly available. I didn't get a straight answer. You've just reminded me I've got to do it again.
Okay.
You noted that Brad Tree Living, you chatted with earlier today. It was posted, I think, 14 hours ago, the 31 Thoughts podcast, worth a listen. What more insight can you lend to us on the Flames GM and what he's going to try to accomplish ahead of the deadline, which is now, what, just 4 weeks and change away?
Well, you know, I don't think we actually didn't get into that a lot, but I kind of have an idea of what he's thinking. I don't think he's overly interested in rentals, depending on the price. I mean, I think a lot of what happens in the next couple of weeks is going to determine what he wants to do. I think he's looking at guys with term. I think that, you know, he's got to make some decisions on his blue line. What's Brody's future? What's Hamonic's future? But I think in the short term, I think it's going to come down to You know, how well do they play? How good his team is? I think the one thing that this year has really done for you and your team and him is it's given them confidence that Riddick is your guy. I think that before this year, I think there was a belief that he could be the guy, but I didn't think they really knew for sure. That's the number one thing I think I've noticed is the confidence is growing that Riddick is your goalie. And I think that's a huge load off what you guys are thinking and what you guys are planning for, that now you think you've got a solution in net. But I think you guys have some decisions around him. I think he'll continue to look for a forward, probably a winger, a right shot with some term. And maybe he goes rental if he really feels he needs it, but I don't think that's his first choice.
So, given that comment on David Riddick, he's a free agent in the summer of 2021, could be extended as soon as this summer. That wouldn't surprise you if that was one of the top priorities this offseason for him?
It wouldn't. Well, look at like what he's done. Like, what's the one contract he's done this year? It's Anderson, right?
Yep.
And that's a guy who's going to be part of your team for a long time. Like if you look at Tree Living, he's always tried to lock up his guys for as long as he can. Monahan, term. Goodrow, term. Anderson, term. Like, his young guys get term. So, now Riddick's a little bit older. He's going to be, what, 28 after next year?
He's 27 now, so depending on the birthday, so yeah, it's 28.
Yeah, so he'll be 28, 29. But, you know, goalies, basically I think we know he's going to try, right? Like, you can assume he's going to try to do it this year.
And then you noted the two free agent defensemen, pending free agents, I should say, TJ Brody and Travis Hamonic. Do you get a sense that there could be a way to recoup some assets that will last longer than this July and then maybe use some of those to get a defender with term, or is that just very convoluted and difficult to connect all those dots rather than let them both walk for free, I guess?
Well, the thing is, like if you're trading guys who are potential UFAs, how are you getting someone with term for them?
Yeah, that's a separate transaction. That's why it's complicated.
The only other way that happens is if there's a team out there that says, I really want Hamonic or I really want Brody, or they're offered permission to extend those guys, or they really want them and they give you something like that. But I don't see it working in that particular way. No. Okay. It seems to me unlikely, but I think what's more likely is that he sees what's out there, and then he says, okay, if we want to make this move, does one of these players appeal to you to help get it done?
Elliot Friedman's with us from Hockey Night. What does the trade market sound like right now, and how much busier will it get between now and the deadline, which, as Pinder already mentioned, only about 4 weeks away?
Well, it's interesting. I'm getting a lot of guys telling me there's a lot more sellers than there are buyers.
Okay.
They think it's like a buyer's market. There's been some teams that have been out there for quite a while talking. And people seem to be really down on rentals. Like, there's, like, you know, I wrote a couple of weeks ago about Tampa, and Julian Brisebois did some research into the last 10 deadlines. And, he wouldn't tell me, but I sat down, I kind of figured it out myself. He basically says, like, at the deadline, you know, a lot of the best teams the teams who've won cups, they haven't done their biggest work at the deadline. Like, Pittsburgh did their Kessel deal on July 1st that helped them win two cups. St. Louis did the O'Reilly deal on July 1st, won a cup, big part of it. Washington's only move was Kempney, and it's been a long time since anyone traded their first rounder at the deadline. And what a lot of other guys have said is that if you look at the amount of guys who cost you a first rounder and the effect that they really had on your team, it's not very high. So I think there's a lot of teams who look at it like that. Now, I think the biggest question is, are there guys going to be available with term? And that's guys like the Toronto guys, the Kapanens, the Janssens, the Kerfoots. Like, and I don't think Toronto is doing that right now. I mean, I could be totally wrong on this, but I think Toronto is going to wait a little bit to see how good are we before we commit to giving up that kind of an asset. But Dumba is kind of like Dumba could get you something. I think the biggest question, guys, is how many decent players with term are going to be available?
If you, like you suggested, if it has been suggested to you that this is indeed a buyer's market, does that mean that we might be talking about perhaps, I don't know, a lower prices when it's all said and done? Like, we've seen trade deadlines where there's some pretty outrageous prices paid for players. A buyer's market, does that change that potentially?
I think the one guy that could kind of change that a bit is Kreider for rentals. I think if he's available, you know, like, if he's available, then I think that if he's available, then my sense is that he'll get you a good price. Okay. But I don't think there's a ton of rentals, Pat, that are going to do that. But okay. If you got the term guys, like guys seem to think more likely than not, Georgiev stays in New York and they deal with all this in the summer. You know, Dumba gets you a haul. I think.
Yep.
I think he really does. But who else gets you a haul? Like, it's going to be a guy with term. Like, Zucker, Pittsburgh knows. Like, it was interesting. Like, earlier in the year, Jim Rutherford said to me he doesn't want to deal his first rounder. And today he was interviewed by Josh Yohan, The Athletic, and he's kind of hemming and hawing a bit now on that. Like, I'm not sure. So that says to me he knows if he wants to get Zucker, who's got term, or someone like that, it's going to cost him his first rounder. So I think the term guys cost you more than the rentals do. I think the only rental who, at least I can think of off the top of my head right here, who costs you a lot is Kreider.
Fascinating. And the Flames consistently pointed out by the media that zero right-shot wingers if they were to field their practice lineup in a game today.
He's been looking at those.
Yeah.
You know, he's really, like you said, when they opened up the cap room, what was the number one thing I got told? If Lindholm's a center, we're looking for a right winger. If Lindholm's a right winger, we could look around a bit. So we'll see.
Last trade deadline, they were what? Some sort of a snafu away from acquiring Jason Zucker. He is a right shot winger.
Yep.
Left shot, excuse me, but can play the right side. Is that unlikely that's revisited, or they liked him before?
Zucker didn't have trade protection then. He's got it now. Right.
He's got it now, yeah.
So I would bet he could block it. That's my guess.
Last one for you then. Sad news yesterday. It seemed to stun everyone. And how couldn't it? A superstar athlete dying at the age of 41 in the fashion that Kobe Bryant did, with his daughter, no less. An incredibly emotional day for basketball fans and sports fans around the world. How did you digest that?
Well, I mean, you're in shock like everybody else. And I think the thing that's brutal about it is just the incredible amount of damage that this has done to, three or four different families.
Yep.
You know, Vanessa Bryant now is a widow with three daughters. The Altobelli family, there's two kids who lost a sibling and their parents. I think it's Matt Hauser, whose wife, the basketball coach, died. I listened to a radio interview with him today, and, you know, like, you know, that one really resonated with me because, you know, my mother passed away when I was 11, and my father had to raise me and two daughters, my two younger sisters. And, you know, I know what that does when, like, the mother goes. Like, it's all, the bond is always greater between mother and kids than father and kids in most cases because, you know, the mother carries you for 9 months, right? And to me, that's the most brutal thing about it is just the damage it does to the families and the challenge that you have to kind of put one foot in the other in front of the other to get going. And that's the thing I think of. And you think about those last minutes on the last seconds on the copter and what that must have been like for those families. I mean, it's gut-wrenching, really.
Yeah.
You know, as a competitor, you know, I covered a little bit of a few of his games here and there. Like, to me, Jordan was the greatest competitor ever. Like, I was very fortunate to cover Jordan in his heyday and see some things the way he was and the way he made a meaningless Tuesday game against a bad Raptors team, like it was game 7 of the NBA Finals. And Bryant was the closest thing to that. And I think if you really want to be great at anything, you have to be that competitive. And I was always amazed at how Bryant had that Jordan chip that no matter what he was competing with you at, he was going to beat you no matter. And I have incredible admiration for that kind of level of competition and that competitive nature. I think it's a gift. You know, I look at my son, you know, my son's 8 years old, and, you know, there's things he likes and there's things he doesn't like. But at the things he likes, he's a really competitive kid. He wants to do well. He wants to be successful. And I think that is such an important attribute to have. To be good at something and to be successful at something, you have to have a will to compete at the highest level. And that's the thing I admired the most about Bryant as an athlete.
Great chatting. We'll do it again next Monday. Thanks for your time, as always.
Sorry for giving you more work, Elliot.
It's okay, guys. Have a good night. Take care.
Elliot Friedman, brought to you by Calgary Lock and Safe, your store for everything door and more. Installing doors for your business, glass doors, sliding doors, and handicap accessible doors, plus frames and hardware. Visit CalgaryLockAndSafe.com.